Atoms are the ultimate state of the manifest universe. When they stay in their own forms without forming different bodies, they are called unlimited oneness. They are certainly different bodies. There are certainly different bodies in physical forms, but the atoms themselves form the complete manifestation. There's no purport here, so I'll read the next couple of texts till there's a purport. Text number 3. Evam kalo pyanumita sokshmye stolye chasatama samstana bhuktya bhagavan avyakto vyakta bhubhibhu. One can estimate time by measuring the movement of the atomic combination of bodies. Time is the potency of the Almighty Personality of Godhead, Hari, who controls all physical movement, although he is not visible in the physical world. Text number 4. Sakala paramanurvai yobhunte paramanutam satovi shesha bhugyastu sakala paramomahan. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Atomic time is measured according to its covering a particular atomic space. That time, which covers the unmanifest aggregate of atoms, is called the great time. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Time and space are two correlative terms. Time is measured in terms of its covering a certain space of atoms. Standard time is calculated in terms of the movement of the sun. The time covered by the sun in passing over an atom is calculated as atomic time. The greatest time of all covers the entire existence of the non-dual manifestation. All the planets rotate and cover space, and space is calculated in terms of atoms. Each planet has its particular orbit for rotating, in which it moves without deviation, and similarly the sun has its orbit. The complete calculation of the time of creation, maintenance, and dissolution, measured in terms of the circulation of the total planetary systems until the end of creation, is known as the supreme Kala. Om Omagyanatimidandasya karananjana salakaya chaksurun militam jena tasmai shri guruhe dehi namah shri chaitana manobistam stapitam jena bhutale svayam rupakadamayam dharati svaparantikam. Kala is the meaning of time, and time is calculated by the movement of the sun. And as Prabhupada is indicating, every planet has a certain orbit and rotates or circulates, moves through its orbit, rotates in the orbit according to a certain time. And every planet, every so-called star that exists in the universe has a certain orbit and manifests a certain way according to that orbit, acts according to a certain way. So there have been throughout history different theories of how the universe works or how it can be seen. One is the way that the sun is the center of everything, heliocentric, and the other is the way that the earth is the center of everything. That's called geocentric. So it can be seen in different ways. If you calculate that the earth is the center of everything, then the sun, the moon, and all the planets and stars and different other planets have their orbits around the earth, including the sun. And if you see the sun as the center of everything, then the earth and all the other stars and planets have their, and the moon, all the moons, have their way of circulating around the sun. So they're actually calculated in different ways. There's a very nice video, if you haven't seen it, called I think it's called Mysterious Orbits, that Sataputta has produced, which shows what the orbits of the different heavenly bodies are and how they move relative to the sun, how they move relative to the earth. And everything is calculated very nicely. So Prabhupada wanted his disciples to elucidate further upon the fifth canon of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which gives the structure of the universe according to the Vedas. And some ways it's similar, in some ways it's different from the way that the modern astronomers see the universe. So one of the projects in Mayapur is to create a planetarium given the structure of the universe as seen through the Vedic literature. So one theory is that unless the structure of the universe is properly seen and understood according to the Vedic model, then it's difficult to say anything else about heavenly bodies, the earth, the stars, the sun, or the moons, or even anything. So one of Prabhupada's desires was to create a planetarium which would challenge standard views of why the seasons change, or exactly how the stars and sun and moon and earth rotate according to what modern theory says they do. So this will be one of Prabhupada's important projects. Everything is calculated here according to time and the atom, how much space is there, according to how long it takes a particular body to move across the atom, time is calculated. And of course Prabhupada talks about universal time as the great time, or Kala. In the spiritual world, time is not passing in the ordinary way. Sometimes we talk about the pastimes of Krishna, but in one sense, there is no past time, and there's no future time, because all time just exists as present time. So it's eternal time, time existing all the time in the spiritual world. It's a different method of time as we know it. In our way of measuring time, everything comes into existence and it grows and it maintains for some time, has some offspring, dwindles and dies. These are the six manifestations of time for objects that come into existence in the material world. But in spiritual existence, time is different. Time is continuous. So we have things like relationships that grow and they don't deteriorate, like the relationships between Krishna and Radharani and the gopis. These are called achincha, or inconceivable, actually impossible to understand by material standards. There is a relationship described in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita between Radha and Krishna that grows and increases every moment by a million times, and then every moment later increases a million times more. And this continues eternally in a never-ending upward spiral, so to speak. So this is inconceivable to us, because everything that we know has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Every story has a beginning, it has a middle, and an end. Everything that comes into existence has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But in the spiritual environment, where the soul is in its only natural state, everything is on the increase. Everything is increasing, improving, deepening, maturing, without any end. So there's no end. That's the meaning of eternal. That's also a concept which is very difficult for a materialist to grasp. Eternity. What does it mean? And in spiritual existence, we know it means that there's no beginning and no end. And as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, there never was a time when you and I did not exist. He's referring to Arjuna, the living entities. Mama evamso jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. The living entities are part and parcel of Krishna. And there is no beginning and no end. So in spiritual world, that sense of beginningless and endlessness is very apparent to every being who exists in the spiritual world. In the material world, because time is finite, at least for these bodies, everyone is very attached to time. And time becomes the most valuable thing, practically speaking, that a human being can treasure. People will do anything to extend their life. There's a somewhat widespread philosophy now, a part of the New Age movement. It's sometimes called life extension theory. The idea is that you can live a long time. I saw an advertisement of a man water skiing without skis, just on his bare feet, and his hands were free because he held the rope in his teeth, and he looked kind of aged. And the advertisement said that a 90-year-old is much younger than he was 50 years ago. It was an ad from an insurance company. And the idea was, the copy said that because of advances in medical science, now a person can, at an old age, live like a young person. And it was giving all sorts of evidence about how this is possible. So people will do that. They'll try to extend their lives. And maybe, of course, it's difficult, according to Vedic standards, according to horoscopes and lines in the hand, to exceed your karma. But maybe people can live a little bit more vigorous life. But at any rate, there's a time when it has to come to an end. So people will, because it's so valuable, if they're affluent, they'll pay their doctor anything to extend their life, even if it's only for a few more years, or even a few more days, or even hours. It's so valuable. And it's said by Chanakya Pandit that time is so valuable that people will pay anything to get even one moment of time back, one moment of time that's passed, but it can never be gotten back for any amount of money or any amount of endeavor. One moment that's passed, yesterday was the 19th, no amount of money can ever bring it back and make today the 20th, the 19th, it's not possible. So time is very, very valuable to the living entity, and as life continues to ebb away, it just doesn't stop. There's a saying in English that time and tide wait for no one. There's no way to slow it down, no way to stop it. It is a great fear among the materialists that time will erode everything. Some day, a person looks in the mirror and sees a gray hair, and then some panic begins to set in. It doesn't wait. And of course, in order to alleviate that or to forget about it, then immediately there's some thought about how to spend time in such a way that it's enjoyable. Now it's said that when you're having a good time in the material world, time seems to pass by. Time flies when you're having fun, they say. And if you're not having a good time, it seems to just drag on endlessly. Like you're outside waiting for the bus, and it's freezing cold, and the wind is blowing, and it seems like 1 minute takes hours and hours. You just wish you could get in the bus or the car and get warm again. So sometimes it seems like it's going by really fast, sometimes it seems like it's going by very slow. When I was young, I read a story about someone who tried to stop time. He had some kind of, it was a fiction, science fiction story. He had a watch that could stop time. So what he would do is he would stop everything, and then he would go and steal as much as he could steal from jewelry shops and banks, and then start it up again. So one day his karma caught up with him. He woke up in the night and he heard this bong, 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 and it was the clock on the wall, and every bong was 1 hour. So time was just going by so fast, and he jumped up and he looked in the mirror, and he was very wrinkled and old, and his teeth were loose and his hair was all gray, and he became horrified. So he took this stopwatch and flung it against the wall as hard as he could, and it stopped time. But because the watch was broken, he could never start it again. So that was the end of the story, that he was wandering through the world and everything was just completely frozen. And that was what he had to pay for stealing. Anyway, I don't know how relevant that is to this verse, but I just happened to think, when I was very young, I started to think about time and how valuable it is, how a person tries to stop time so they don't age, and then somehow or other, it doesn't really work. It's not always possible to obtain these things. So Lord Brahma says that one should persevere in one's devotional activities. Tattenu kampam susamikshamano. Prabhupada quotes this verse from the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, that one should always and very earnestly await for the Lord to bestow His causeless mercy on him. Tattenu kampam susamikshamano. Bunjana evatma kripa vipakam. And all the while, one has to suffer the reactions of past deeds or past misdeeds. And at the same time, if one offers obeisances to the Lord with body, mind, and words, and heart, then one is eligible for liberation. One is rightly situated and becomes eligible for liberation because he is rightly situated. So in other words, even though time may bring with it so many anomalies, so many difficulties, and so many sufferings, if one continues to persevere in devotional service, then that person becomes very dear to the Lord, because he is rightly situated and he's not swayed by the changes in time. He becomes titiksha karunaka, suvida sarva bhutanam. It is stated in Lord Kapila's teachings that one should practice tolerance. One has to understand that the material world is made up of troughs and crests. It will not always be smooth ride. But nevertheless, one who is steady and perseverant, Matra Sparsha Stukunteya, and in Bhagavad Gita it is also stated that one should always continue even though it is sometimes cold, it is sometimes hot, it is sometimes difficult, it is sometimes easy, Sitoshna Sukha Dukkha Da. Sometimes it is winter, sometimes it is summer. Tamsa Tikshva Sabharata, but one should learn the practice of tolerance. And time is another thing that has to be tolerated, the passing of time. Prabhupada was an example of someone who, even though very elderly, seemed to defy the laws of material nature and that of growing old. When we read of the story of King Puranjan, the fourth canto, we understand how time, kala, is an eroding factor. It takes away all the good qualities of the living entity. And one becomes very morose in old age, unable to satisfy their desires, almost like a ghost, because the senses are so weak. I'm going to read a portion of that chapter from the fourth canto, chapter 27 of King Niranjan, which explains how devotional service makes it possible to supersede or to transcend the usual barriers that time creates for us in the material world. This is a discussion about Kalakanya, or old age, the daughter of time, trying to find a mate or a husband. Very wonderful metaphor. Actually, she tried to betroth Narada Muni, and Narada Muni rejected this proposal. And as a result, Kalakanya cursed Narada Muni. He would have to keep traveling all over the world. So this was actually, he considered this a blessing, that he would be able to travel, because he was doing it anyway, but this was like an additional blessing, that he would not be able to stay in one place, get too comfortable, but have to continue his travels. So the verse here is the 24th verse of the 27th chapter. Vishabham yovanam tam vine vare psitam patim sankalpas payi bhutanam kritakala narishyati. Approaching the king of the Yavanas, still searching for a husband, Kalakanya addressed him as a great hero, saying, "My dear sir, you are the best of the untouchables. I am in love with you, and I want you as my husband. I know that no one is baffled if he makes friends with you." So this is Prabhupada's purport. The words Yovanam Rishabham refer to the king of the Yavanas. It's Yavanam Rishabham. The Sanskrit words Yavana and Malecha apply to those who do not follow the Vedic principles. According to the Vedic principles, one should rise early in the morning, take bath, chant Hare Krishna, offer Mangal Arati to the deities, study Vedic literature, take prasad, and engage in dressing and decorating the deities. One must also collect money for the temple expenditures, or if one is a householder, he must go to work in accordance with the prescribed duties of a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra. In this way, one should live a life of spiritual understanding, and this is the Vedic way of civilization. One who does not follow all of these rules and regulations is called a yavana or malecha. One should not mistakenly think that these words refer to certain classes of men in other countries. There is no question of limitation according to nationalism. Whether one lives in India or outside of India, he is called a yavana or a malecha if he does not follow Vedic principles. One who does not actually follow the hygienic principles prescribed in the Vedic rules and regulations will be subjected to many contagious diseases. Because the students in this Krishna consciousness movement are advised to follow Vedic principles, they naturally become hygienic. If a person in Krishna consciousness can, if a person is Krishna conscious, he can work like a young man, even if he is 75 or 80 years old. Thus, the daughter of time, of Kala, cannot overcome a Vaishnava. Srila Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami engaged in writing Chaitanya Chaitamrita when he was very old, yet he presented the most wonderful literature about the activities of Lord Chaitanya. Srila Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami begin their spiritual lives at a very old age. That is, they did so after they retired from their occupations and family lives. Yet they presented many valuable literatures for the advancement of spiritual life. This is confirmed by Srila Srinivasacharya, who says, "I offer my respectful obeisances unto the six Goswamis." This is the verse, "Nana Shastra Vichara Naikani Puno Sadharma Samstapako." Namely, Sri Sanatan, Sri Rupa, Sri Raghunath Bhatta Goswami, Sri Raghunath Das Goswami, Sri Jiva Goswami, and Sri Gopala Bhatta Goswami, who are very expert in scrutinizingly studying all the revealed scriptures with the aim of establishing eternal religious principles for the benefit of human beings. Thus they are honored all over the three worlds, and they are worth taking shelter of, because they are absorbed in the mood of the gopis and are engaged in the transcendental loving service of Radha and Krishna. Lokanam hitakarino tribhuvane manyo sharanyakaro Radha Krishna padara vinda bhajanandena mataliko Vandi rupa sanatana ragujugo shri jiva gopalako. Thus jara, the effect of old age, does not harass a devotee. This is because a devotee follows the instructions and the determination of Narada Muni. All devotees in the disciplic succession stemming from Narada Muni, because they worship the deity according to Narada's direction, namely the Narada Pancharatna or the Panchara Trikividi. A devotee follows the principles of Panchara Trikividi as well as Bhagavat Vidi. Bhagavat Vidi includes preaching work, Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu, or hearing and chanting of the glories of Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Panchara Trikividi includes Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam. Because the devotee rigidly follows the instructions of Narada Muni, he has no fear of old age, disease, or death. Apparently, a devotee may grow old, but he is not subjected to the symptoms of defeat experienced by a common man in old age. Consequently, old age does not make a devotee fearful of death, as a common man is fearful of death. When jara, or old age, takes shelter of a devotee, kalakanya diminishes the devotee's fear. A devotee knows that after death, he is going back home, back to Godhead. Therefore, he has no fear of death. Thus, instead of depressing a devotee, advanced age helps him become fearless and thus happy. So Prabhupada had an appropriate name, Abhay, fearless. And as we saw, and is the case with devotees, they, as they age, they rather than become more fearful of death, as is the case of one who is embodied and attached to a material body, they become more and more fearless of death. When we were staying in Berry Place, one neighbor used to complain about the noise. So we had a discussion with him once, and a kind of philosophical person. So he lived right next door to the temple, and we got to talking about death and old age and how it causes fear. So he said that sometimes he would wake up in the night and think of dying in all kinds of horrible ways because he was approaching old age. And he appreciated, even though he didn't like the noise, so-called noise, he appreciated the fact that devotees could overcome this kind of fear. And of course, there's the example of Bhishma too. And he was, of course, he had the benediction that he could leave his body whenever he wanted. But he was perfectly composed, even though he was shot full of arrows and dripping blood. He was perfectly composed. In fact, he spoke very wonderful shlokas, and he addressed everyone who came to see him, Arjuna and Krishna and the Pandavas, exactly according to proper etiquette, because his mind was unaffected. Actually, there's a story from the Mahabharata about how he was speaking very clear principles of Dharma when he noticed that Draupadi, who was also there, was smiling in a kind of sardonic, smirking way. And he asked her, "Why are you smiling at a time like this?" And she said that when I was in the court of the Kurus and they were trying to disrobe me, you sat there and you didn't interfere, you didn't intervene, you just sat as if nothing was going on. And now you're speaking principles of Dharma. You're speaking absolute principles. So I just thought it was a little ironic. So he explained that actually what happened was I was in their court and I was I was attached to them, and I had to pay a certain amount of tribute to them. I had to be obedient, in a sense. Maybe you call it diplomacy. But I was also eating their food. And because I was eating their food and associating with them so intimately, my whole bloodstream became contaminated. But now that I have been stricken with all these arrows and all the blood has drained out of my body, I think I've become purified enough to speak Dharma. So he spoke, and a whole parva of the Mahabharata in a way that was remembered for all time in the Mahabharata. And she was very pleased to hear his introduction and began to listen attentively in a very sober way. And when Prabhupada was translating the 10th canon of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we've read how penetrating his commentaries were, even though he was in a condition that most doctors said that an ordinary man would be in agony, in painful agony. So in any condition, the devotee, as we're reading here, is not affected in the usual way by the passage of time, if devotional principles are followed. And of course, in the Bhagavad Gita, we're instructed, yuktahara viharasya yuktachestasta karmasu, that one should be moderate in the habits of eating, sleeping, working, recreation, service. And in this way, the body will remain stout and strong to serve the Lord in devotional service. So we'll end here. Any comments or questions? Rupa Goswami advises the nectar of instruction, Upadesha Amrita, Utsaha Nishchaya Dharya. First, these are the six principles by which devotional service can be successful. Utsaha Nishchaya Dharya Tattat Karma Pravartana. One should be enthusiastic. That's the very first principle, Utsaha, or sometimes called Ruchi. And if that enthusiasm for devotional principles and preaching is maintained, and one is also patient and determined and associates with the right people and avoids bad associations, sangha tyagat sutta vritte, following the principles of devotional service like shravanam and kirtanam, then one will be successful. So it's not automatic in the sense that one takes initiation. Initiation means beginning in English. So beginning is like the first step. Then the next step is to maintain that high level of enthusiasm for practicing devotional principles, not associating intimately with those who are not devotees, following Vedic principles, following the footsteps of the great saint Sutta Vritte, and being confident that Krishna will appear to us at the end of everything and be very, very determined. So all these things are interrelated, these six things: enthusiasm, determination, patience, avoiding bad association, following in the footsteps of others, following devotional principles. These six things are all interrelated, and if one maintains all those things, it will be easy to maintain any one of them. But the first thing is one has to be enthusiastic. That is, one should be just as enthusiastic about running to the Srimad Bhagavatam class as one is about going out and distributing books, or preaching to an individual in the temple, or reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, knowing that the Krishna consciousness, if one follows the principle, as I was mentioning before, it's an increasing principle. It's an ever-expanding principle, spiritual life. So if one is tapping into the spiritual world, then one is being pulled along that timelessness, along that path of timelessness, which is eternally full of bliss and knowledge and is absolute and is full of enthusiasm. So it's an incursion of Maya if after some time the enthusiasm wanes, and I think, why can't it just be like it was when I first saw a devotee, when I first saw the deity, when I first heard the Maha Mantra? Why can't it be like that? Well, that's the incursion of Maya, because it always is like that. In fact, according to Rupa Goswami, one's enthusiasm should continue, and one should be more and more enthusiastic to hear, to chant, to remember as time goes on. So it's sometimes said that the devotional creeper is very delicate, and sometimes weeds surround it and strangle it, because Maya and Krishna are always in opposition. There's a type of parasite that grows up around a tree. I've seen them in rainforests. And what they do is they grow up like creepers around a large trunk of the tree and become stronger and stronger, parasitically feeding off the tree, and then pretty soon there's no tree left, there's just a creeper. So in that way, Maya can destroy the devotional creeper. Therefore, one is advised to be very vigilant that such things do not come in, and they enter in a very subtle fashion. Just like if the enthusiasm wanes, or Prabhupada once said that our spirituality would be judged on how jovial or jolly we are. So if that enthusiasm and that kind of moroseness sets in, that's an indication that Maya is overtaking us. So it may seem escapist that, you know, one is always happy and jolly and optimistic and enthusiastic, but enthusiasm, patience, determination, following in the footsteps of the great saints, avoiding association that's contaminating, and following the Vedic principles will keep one very enthusiastic. I heard Sridhar Maharaj give a talk once, and he said that Prabhupada was asked once, "Do you, why is it that you never seem to have a down day, a time when you're not enthusiastic?" And his answer was that I follow all the principles and all the Vedic rituals to the letter. You know, I'm very strict about my vows, and therefore I'm always enthusiastic. So the thing which seems humdrum and monotonous in spiritual life may, such as the things we were mentioning, following devotional principles, attending the morning programs, we were reading, going to Mangalarti, getting up early and so forth, are the very things which give us enthusiasm to continue with great endeavor and working hard. So in one sense, Krishna can change time. Time as we know it goes by the watch or the clock. But in devotional service, even though we're still in a material world, things change. Just as we were reading, in old age, people don't, in devotion, experience the same kinds of anomalies that are experienced. So similarly, Krishna can, even in this material world, change time. And one of the ways we can see that evidence is how Prabhupada wrote so much in so little time, how he produced so much, how he created such a big movement in a very short amount of time. This apparently defies the laws of material nature. Once I took a gentleman to meet Prabhupada who was an international lawyer and financier. He worked for the Rothschild family, and he was a millionaire at age 25. So he met Prabhupada and met some of the devotees and visited the LA temple and went through some of the morning programs and spent a couple of days there. And afterwards, he said, "You know, I've been analyzing your movement very closely, and I see that there's some other force that seems to be at work, because the amount of ground that Prabhupada has covered, and the number of temples that have been set up, the amount of books that have been published, and the numbers of people that have joined, are actually defy the laws by which I work, the laws of any organization progressing the way it did." So it, to him, it was even to him, a way of time being changed or altered or compressed, we might say, according to Krishna. So these kinds of things happen in devotional service. People are very fond of miracles. They're very attracted by something that's called miraculous. Somebody goes to Lourdes and they get their varicose veins eradicated, or someone puts their hands on them, they become healed. Whatever it is, a miracle is something that people wonder at. They may not believe in it. Cows drinking. Perform a miracle. I think you know this story. And he was on a train in India with a few Western disciples. And he said, "This is my miracle." And he gestured, pointed to all the Western devotees and created bhaktas out of them, shaved up. So it is, in one sense, a miraculous thing that people could give up the material world and join Krishna consciousness. So we should try to maintain that understanding and enthusiasm why we're here, and how the spiritual world is an ever-increasing principle. Yeah. I think, well, I'll just repeat it. He was asking the difference between being grave and morose. And if we're grave, we might appear to be unenthusiastic or sad. But gravity, meaning to be the same. It means that we shouldn't be overly elated in times of auspiciousness or good fortune, nor should we be overly depressed in times of reverse. I was noticing as I drove in that someone had vandalized the name from the front of the gates. You know, someone might say that's a cause to be morose. Or, you know, we got permission to have the manor. We're public worship, it's time to rejoice. The gravity means that one is equipoised in success or failure. And proceeds in a very determined way in Krishna consciousness. It doesn't mean that one loses one's enthusiasm or is not optimistic. Prabhupada said we should try to see on the bright side or see the good in everything or in everyone. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't think that something bad won't ever happen. In fact, in another lecture, I remember hearing that Prabhupada said we should always be thinking all the things that can go wrong. And he gave the example of a businessman being successful by always knowing what the plots of his enemies and his competitors were. Everything that can go wrong, we should be aware. At the same time, we should progress with the enthusiasm that Krishna is always there. And if something does go wrong, we're going to do our best to overcome it and rely on Krishna to help us. So that's gravity. Gravity means soberness. And soberness means being aware of both success and failure, of both what can go wrong and what can go right. So it's not depression. Sochatina kangshati. It's not part of our philosophy to lament. So I think we better stop here. It's gone. I've gone about 15 minutes over. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritam naram chaivam narottamam devim saraswatim vyasam datho jayam udirayet nasta prayeshu abhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati utama shloke bhakti bhavati naishtiki. So we're reading this morning from the 4th canto, 28th chapter, 51st verse, 51st text, translations and purports by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Tatra Purvatara Kasti Saka Brahmana Atmavan Santayan Boguna Samna Tam Aha Rudatim Trabo Tatra Purvatara Kasti Tatra Purvatara Kasti Sakha Brahmana Atmavan Sakha Brahmana Atmavan Santvayan Vaguna Samna Sadayan Vaguna Samna Tamaharudatim Prabhu Tamaharudatim Prabhu Tatra Purvata Rakashit Sakha Brahmana Atmavan Santayan Vaguna Samna Tamaharudatim Prabhu Tatra Purvata Rakashit Sakha Brahmana Atmavan Santayan Vaguna Samna Tamaharudatim Prabhu Maharatim Prabhu Tatra Purvata Rakashi Ladies. Brahman. Atmavan, very learned scholar. Santvayan, pacifying. Valguna, by very nice. Samna, mitigating words. Tam, unto her. Aha, he said. Rudatim, while she was crying. Prabho, my dear king. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. My dear king, one Brahmin who was an old friend of King Paranjana came to that place and began to pacify the queen with sweet words. Responsibly, my dear king, one Brahmana who was an old friend of King Paranjana came to that place and began to pacify the queen with sweet words. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The appearance of an old friend in the form of a Brahman is very significant. In his Paramatma feature, Krishna is the old friend of everyone. According to Vedic injunction, Krishna is sitting with the living entity side by side. According to the Shruti mantra, Vasuparanasa Yuja Sakaya, The Lord is sitting within the heart of every living entity as Suhrit, the best friend. The Lord is always eager to have the living entity come home, back to Godhead. Sitting with the living entity as witness, the Lord gives him all chances to enjoy himself materially. But whenever there is an opportunity, the Lord gives good counsel and advises the living entity to abandon trying to become happy through material adjustment, and instead turn his face toward the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrender unto him. When one becomes serious to follow the mission of the spiritual master, his resolution is tantamount to seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As explained before, this means meeting the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the instruction of the spiritual master. This is technically called Vani Seva. Srila Viswanath Chakravarti Thakur states in his Bhagavad Gita commentary on the verse Vyavasaya Mika Budir Ekeha Kuru Nandana 241 that one should serve the words of the spiritual master. The disciple must stick to whatever the spiritual master orders. Simply by following on that line, one sees the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Paramatma, appeared before the queen as a Brahmin. But why didn't he appear in his original form as Sri Krishna? Srila Viswanath Chakravarti Thakur remarks that unless one is very highly elevated in loving the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one cannot see him as he is. Nonetheless, if one sticks to the principles enunciated by the spiritual master, somehow or other, he is in association with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Since the Lord is in the heart, he can advise a sincere disciple from within. That is also confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Tesham Satata Yuktanam Bhajatam Pariti Purvakam Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam Yena Mam Upayanti Te. To those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. Bhagavad Gita 10:10. In conclusion, if a disciple is very serious to execute the mission of the spiritual master, he immediately associates with the Supreme Personality of Godhead by Vani or Vapu. This is the only secret of success in seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Instead of being eager to see the Lord in some bush of Vrindavan, while at the same time engaging in sense gratification, if one instead sticks to the principle of following the words of the spiritual master, he will see the Supreme Personality of Godhead without difficulty. Srila Bilva Mangal Thakur has therefore said, Bhaktistvayi siratara bhagavan yadi syat daivena na palati divya kishora murti mukti svayam mukulitanjali sevate sman dharmartha kama gataya samaya pratiksha. If I am engaged in devotional service unto you, my dear Lord, then very easily can I perceive your presence everywhere. And as far as liberation is concerned, I think that liberation stands at my door with folded hands, waiting to serve me. And all material conveniences of dharma, religiosity, artha, economic development, and kama, sense gratification, stand with her from the Krishna Karnamrita, verse number 107. If one is very highly advanced in devotional service, he will have no difficulty in seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If one engages in the service of the spiritual master, he not only sees the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but attains liberation. as far as material conveniences are concerned, they automatically come. Just as the maidservants of a queen follow the queen wherever she goes. Liberation is no problem for the pure devotee, and all material conveniences are simply awaiting him at all stages of life. Om agyana timirandasya agyananjana salakaya chaksur unmilitam jena tasmai shri gurave namaha sri chaitana manobistam stapitam jena bhutale svayam rupakadamayam tadati svaparantikam. Prabhupada is addressing some very important points in his purport to this verse. I noticed that he used the word sticks, three times by way of emphasizing the importance of remembering the words of the spiritual master and taking them as one's life and soul. Prabhupada told one of his disciples once he should concentrate on distributing books and he should not deviate his mind for one moment from those instructions. So sticking to the order of the spiritual master is not such an easy thing, especially when one considers that one is expected not to deviate one's mind for one moment from such instructions. The significance of the Brahman acting as Paramatma, or one of the spiritual masters of the queen. Krishna, of course, is the original spiritual master, is very significant, especially since he's being called Surit. Shishi Panchatattva, Shishi Radha Madhava, Astasaki Kija. Krishna is the supreme friend of everyone, and he declares this in the Bhagavad Gita. Bhaktarang Jagatapa Sam Sarvaloka Maheshwaran Suridam Sarvabhutanam. And again, Ishvara Sarvabhutanam. Ishvara is the controller and the friend of everyone. Rideshe Junatishtativ. Now, when one might think that if Krishna is the friend of everyone, at least this is the thinking of those who are not spiritually tuned in, that to be the friend of everyone is spreading oneself very thin. Once in a lecture, Prabhupada was asked, how can I call Krishna my Lord? How can I say that he is mine? And how can we apply such a title to Krishna if he is advertising to be everybody's Lord? So Prabhupada answered that you can't have a monopoly on Krishna. Krishna has a monopoly on everyone else, but one can have a monopoly on Krishna. We can call him my Lord, and he is my Lord. But anyone who sincerely calls him my Lord also gets the full benefit and the full reciprocation of Krishna as the Surit, supreme friend of everyone. As a super soul, Krishna is so kind that he goes everywhere, be it a drinking house, a brothel, or any other nasty place. He accompanies the living entity. So this is the meaning of best friend. There's no best friend anywhere that will be with us everywhere in all circumstances at all times. But Krishna is that kind of friend. That is the kind of friend that everyone is actually looking for, knowingly or unknowingly. We hear so much talk these days about trying to find the perfect relationship, the lasting understanding, the shelter, understanding and love people are looking for. Everyone is looking for. And whenever that shelter is taken in the wrong place, the result is disaster. Sometimes we look kind of tongue-in-cheek at the people walking their dogs in the morning and waiting for the dogs to do their business, and in that way having to serve their dog. But they are taking shelter in their dog. Everybody is taking shelter in something or someone. And sometimes, even our own brethren get misled and try to take shelter in some spiritual, quasi-spiritual personality who may look very sage-like, with a beard and very elderly, and so on. But that is not the kind of shelter, if it is outside of this movement, that we mean when we say to take shelter of Srila Prabhupada. Because shelter and love and understanding mean not just platitudes or superficial, shallow sayings, but active engagement, involvement. Rupa Goswami says to Dati Pradigranati, if there is love, there is constant exchange, not only in the form of gifts and prasadam, but acts of devotion, acts of friendship. We may call them gifts. Yes, they are gifts. They're gifts of love. But they are constant. Devotional service is just such a kind of gift or relationship. It is perfect reciprocation. In the material world, there is no perfect reciprocation. Gratitude is described by one of Shakespeare's characters as thy marble-hearted friend. Gratitude, thy marble-hearted friend. Meaning, there is no gratitude in this material world. There's no proper reciprocation. And even if one's investments are successful and one gains a certain modicum of happiness in this material world, it will not go with the living entity at the time of death. Work so hard. There was a song when I was about 8 years old. You work so hard, you worry so, but you can't take your dough when you go, go, go. But if we can't take it ourselves, we want our children to take it, our grandchildren to take it. And we've heard so many warnings by Srila Prabhupada about the fallacy, about the folly of trying to think that we can do anything beyond this lifetime significant other than engage in loving devotional service to Krishna. So if there's actually to be a shelter and understanding and love, it has to be with constant activity. In one of Prabhupada's purports, he described the devotee as being daring and active. Daring and active. So there has to be constant renewal or proof that our devotional service is real. It's not just that I'm going to attain some other worldly salvation and go back to Godhead. But the injunction is simultaneous with that. I'm trying to take as many conditioned souls back with me to the spiritual world. This is the behest of Srila Prabhupada. We try to become pure devotees and try to make as many other people pure devotees as we can and take them back to Godhead with us. And of course, we have to be pure ourselves. And when one becomes enthralled with Krishna, at least is sticking to the orders of the spiritual master and having some vision that Krishna is present in those instructions, one overflows with happiness and overflows with love. Not platitudinous, superficial, shallow kind of love, but real love. In one of Prabhupada's lectures, he said that one who becomes a lover of Krishna becomes a lover of everyone in the universe. So one will overflow with this feeling of wanting to share Krishna consciousness. And therefore, the urgent urge to preach Krishna consciousness will also well up in the heart of such a person who sticks to the orders of the spiritual master and develops love for Krishna. And similarly, one who engages in the instruction of the spiritual master, his request to all of us, his sons and grandsons and granddaughters and grandsons, was to spread Krishna consciousness as far, as wide as possible, as one can do in one's lifetime. So as one engages in that process, with loyalty and obedience and faith in the orders of the spiritual master, then one also is compelled to develop spiritual purity. Because what can I say? What can I say to a conditioned soul unless I myself have some realization about spiritual purity? An interesting point here was that in Prabhupada's purport, he uses the word opportunity. He says that Krishna is always beckoning a conditioned soul to come back to him and enjoy the spiritual world. But he says he's also looking for the opportunity, whenever there is an opportunity. So what does that mean? Krishna can make anything happen anytime he wants. But the opportunity arises when the conditioned soul as we heard the other day from Giriraj Maharaj in his very nice lecture, that Prabhupada said that both Maya and the devotees are trying to bring everyone back to Krishna. They just have different methods, Maya by kicking and the devotee by gentle persuasion. So sometimes when one is kicked enough, there's an opportunity, and Krishna seizes that opportunity, even though he's always beckoning the conditioned soul. If one has actually love for the spiritual master, one will have love for his vani. And in that way, by being obedient and faithful and loyal, and I think Rabindranath Prabhupada was using the word fidelity yesterday, very important word, because what do we mean by love if there isn't fidelity and faithfulness and honesty and obedience to those directions? So just as Krishna takes the opportunity, we also take the opportunity, because we're, after all, Krishna's followers. And that opportunity, he says, Prabhupada says, we are the greatest opportunists. We're the greatest of all opportunists. We're looking for that one moment in the life of someone when there is an opportunity to speak about Krishna and for them to hear. So the Paramatma feature is also looking, and according to the circumstances, he comes. In this case, as a Brahmin, very popular disguise. Ravana was very successful in his disguise also as a Brahmin. Sometimes he comes directly as the super soul. Sometimes he comes as one of the Vishnu incarnations. But he comes according to the situation. Or sometimes it is said, Desha Kala Patra. And that is also part of the charge of devotees. Just as we know, when we're speaking to someone, we size them up, we look at them, we may ask them a few questions. Who are you? Where do you come from? And if we're giving them a book or speaking to them, we consciously or unconsciously think about the time and the place and the circumstance. And then, as was mentioned here, this Brahmin was speaking in a very sweet way, in sweet words. So devotees also, in pursuance of the instructions of their spiritual master, they speak very sweetly. Prabodhananda Saraswati gave an instruction that Prabhupada often quoted in the Chaitanya Chidamrita. Dante ni dayatri ni kam padayorni patyak vidva chakaku shatame tada hambravami. He sarava sakala nehavi hayadurad Chaitanya Chandra Charane Kurutanu Ragam. Kurutanu Ragam. I take a straw in my teeth and I bow to you over and over again like a stick. I offer my dandavat. And I speak very sweetly, thousands of kakushatam, the thousands of sweet words. And then I become your friend by doing this. And when I become your friend, because I'm your friend, I ask you a little favor. And that favor is, since you're my friend, to please listen to the wonderful mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who has infinite mercy on all the conditioned souls. So Prabhupada was advising that according to the situation, if one is very humble by wearing the third verse of the Shikshastakam around our neck, we can become adored by everyone. That's part of the charge of the spiritual master. So yesterday we were hearing about the words, the vani of the spiritual master, the mission of the spiritual master, and what is that mission. Obviously, Prabhupada's mission was to preach Krishna consciousness and spread it very far and wide, according to the situation. When I was first alone with Prabhupada, he gave me an instruction which I didn't understand. I went to see him on the Bowery, and there was a lot of noise on the street, trucks going in both lanes, each direction. So I was calling up to the window. The person that stayed with him was named Paul. I think he's named David in the Lilamrita. Paul, Paul. And nobody came to the window. And the trucks were rumbling. And I was yelling, Paul, as loud as I could up to the third floor. And nobody was coming. So finally I took to what people in New York sometimes do when they don't get a response, hollering up to the second or third or fourth floor. And I started throwing pennies at the window. I hadn't been practicing playing baseball for a long time, so it was good practice for me. Finally, after several hits and after several misses, Prabhupada himself came to the window, opened the window up and looked at me, and he just kind of made this kind of a gesture as if to say, just 1 minute, I'll come and fetch you. Because the door was locked. I didn't know how else to get up there. So Prabhupada himself came down four flights of stairs. It was four flights. And I was so embarrassed as soon as he came to the door. All I could do was say, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean for you to come down. I was hoping Paul would be there. And he was just shaking his head, saying, never mind, come with me. And before I knew it, he was taking the stairs two at a time, way ahead of me. So I got my first glimpse of Prabhupada in alone behind the barrier where he was behind him when he lectured. And there were old clothes hanging up. There was an old typewriter and stacks of manuscripts of his Bhagavad Gita. They weren't old clothes, but they were his own washing hanging up. And I was amazed how humbly he lived. So because of being a very conditioned soul, he began to speak to me to make the words penetrate, and had to talk on a very, you might say, superficial level, at least for me. So one of the things he said, it was about an hour and a half long conversation, he asked me what I did. So I told him I was a musician. What do you play? I play the keyboards, piano. And this was about an hour into the conversation. And he said, oh, that I can teach you how to play the piano for Krishna. And I thought, this is not possible. Flute, yes, but piano, no way. So I just kind of forgot about it after a while. I was thinking that somehow Prabhupada was trying to busy me in some activity, some way of doing whatever he wanted to do, and I wasn't prepared to make that degree of surrender. So I just really forgot about those instructions. They were instructions, but I forgot about them. And it wasn't until some time later, a few years later, that a group of devotees and myself were recording the Govinda Mari Purusham and the Hare Krishna Mantra, and I was playing the organ and the keyboard. So those instructions, which were long forgotten, given to me by Srila Prabhupada, were manifest, they were carried out, and I'm reminded of them every day when I hear the Govindam prayers in a way that I hope I won't forget, that whatever the words of the spiritual master are, they have deep meaning. And if one is to actually see the personality of Godhead, one has to see them in the instructions of the spiritual master. So, we'll stop here. I made the sin of being late again. Should we take maybe one or two? Or is it, it's pretty late? Jai Dwaita Maharaj.
You mentioned that sometimes people take shelter of someone outside of ISKCON who appears to be a saintly person and so on. So what do we do if it sometimes appears to us that someone outside of ISKCON is, in fact, a saintly person and a well-wisher and a learned devotee and so on. And at the same time, we see someone who's a big spiritual leader in ISKCON who appears to be a liar or a politician or a hypocrite or several of the above. And still we're advised to approach them and respect them as spiritual leaders or take shelter of them. How do we accommodate that?
First of all, this is not to say that each and everyone outside of ISKCON cannot give shelter. I'm making a general statement. And your question that someone who is within ISKCON and may appear to be hypocritical and cheating and lying and completely unworthy of taking shelter of, even though we're advised to do so, is also exceptional, although it does happen. And this is our misfortune. This is actually a symptom of our not living by the words of our spiritual master. Our spiritual master not only advised us to preach widely, but first and foremost, to become pure devotees. And when one becomes a pure devotee, one always hearkens to the words of the spiritual master And one hearkens to especially the words of Srila Prabhupada, who is our grand spiritual master, and who said that my disciples, and I interpret this to mean my followers, are such well-behaved ladies and gentlemen that no one can find any fault in them. So everyone in Krishna's family, let us say in ISKCON, we're reading about an allegory, so I'll make this a little metaphorical, is in a way in a big hospital, being cured slowly of the spiritual disease. And we are all acting as doctors and doctor's assistants, maybe running from patient to patient sometimes to try to cure that disease, that very deeply ingrained disease of material contamination in which the soul has come into contact with matter. And on the side of the bed of each patient, we can imagine there might be a chart. The idea is that the chart should start at a low point, get up to a higher point eventually, and that patient can be discharged and go back to the spiritual world. But the chart, as charts tend to do, have troughs and crests. And sometimes the troughs get a bit deeper than the crests, and sometimes they go all the way down, the patient dies. I don't mean to be making a joke about dying. It's a very regrettable and tragic thing. But spiritually, everyone who stays in that hospital and takes the advice of the doctors and the nurses and the medicine, or Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu, we might say, generally will get better. And those who have a certain persona about being a special doctor, but who are not doing a good job, will gradually get dismissed from the hospital and purged. At least we hope, in general, that will be the case. So we make a general statement that one should follow the instructions of Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. Stay within the company of devotees and try to realize that Prabhupada has created a machine, we might say. Sometimes it's described as a boat, a vehicle that is the most successful vehicle in the world for liberating, for bringing the personality of Godhead to the largest number of people in the shortest possible time. That is Prabhupada's great behest to humanity. So in that hospital analogy or metaphor, we're all trying to get cured. And we're hoping that we can be pure enough and get cured enough that we can convince others that this is the hospital they should go to on their way back to Godhead. So I think our time is a little short and we should end now. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Grantharaj Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Stayed up there one night, and just one night, because they took us on a little park down of all the different places. Sham Sundar and I came here. They had been living here for about a year. And I was sleeping outside. It was very hot because it was in September, right after the monsoons. Very, very hot. And so I was sleeping up on the roof, and something woke me up. It was a kind of moonlit night, and I just opened my eyes in time to see a hand groping towards me, and it was reaching for my wallet, which was right by my... One night, and just one night. Now, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Grantharaj Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Stayed up there one night, and just one night,
because they took us on a little program of all the different places. Shyam Sundar and I came here. They had been living here for about a year.
And I was sleeping outside. It was very hot because it was in September, right after the monsoon. It was very, very hot. And so I was sleeping up on the roof, and something woke me up. It was a kind of moonlit night, and I just opened my eyes in time to see a hand groping towards me, and it was reaching for my wallet, which was right by my head, and it was a monkey. Mm-hmm. It was my first experience of a monkey. Mm-hmm. So I just jumped up like that and ran away. So I was very careful from that point on never to leave anything out in the open, even during daytime, because the monkeys are very quick to grab.
During Kartik, this temple is very popular and is visited by many, many people. It's just like we saw earlier, there's a continuous stream of people like because it's Kartik. But this is every day in Kartik, I mean, because it's a Kadasi, and they just keep going and going around. It's considered a very holy, sacred place. And even little children, sometimes you'll see doing the Purkan, and they do these Dandavat Purkan where you walk, lay flat down, step up to where your head was, and you do it again. Even little children, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, are doing this during Kartik this year. I think we saw someone beginning the fight from doing it. You know, they were doing the Dandavat Purkan, little children. Even the huge crowd back at the beginning trampled on them. And they see it as just fun, you know. They're very happy in doing it. It's not an austerity at all. It's like, you know, going on playing or something. So Mandini stayed in his rooms. I think it might have been even more than a year, it might have been 2 years. He was taking care of these rooms. And he said that sometimes the shopkeepers, when he would go in the city, would make fun of him. He would understand a little Indian and knows that they'd call him a monkey or something. And so he said he got a little bit annoyed with some of them. But in Kartik, he'd see some of the same shopkeepers come dressed in their finest silk. And they would come and offer obeisances to Didi and circumambulate. And they would be very respectful. They'd call him Maharaj then. So he said, after that experience, that he tried never to pass judgment on people again, no matter what they might say or do. Because at heart they're really very, very fixed Vaishnavas, devotees, which would be manifest in Buddha. And they would come and see the deity. And all these kind of joking and name-calling things would go away. And he saw them as just being kind of innocuous and playful and not really vindictive or the way we're used to seeing the way people are in the West, that they just say things because they're uptight or in a bad mood or just in a bad way generally. But this was more like some playful kind of joking. Mahanidhi wrote the Prabhupada Radhakamadhan and appreciating the Dhamma Dham. See it there? And appreciating Navaridham, is that there? And that one, and there's another book on Samadhi, so if you know, you see it. That one. And there's Sri Chaitanya Jagannath Puri. Is there somewhere? I thought I saw. No, I don't know. Yeah, there.
Oh.
And he also wrote a book on Radhakund.
Yeah.
May not be there. I've read all except for the Radhakund book and part of the Samadhi book, and I would recommend all those books for any of you to read when you get a chance. I don't know if they're translated into Russian. The wonderful books. I'd start with the earliest books and work up to the later books. First one, I think, was Prabhupada Radhakund. Chaitanya Jagannath Puri, then appreciating the Navaridham, then Radhakund Samadhi is the Navaridham. Of course, Navaridham is such a special book, you can read that anytime. wonderful book. Of all the books, I like that one the best.
This one?
Yeah. Of course, they're all good, and it's just a subjective feeling. It's not necessarily the best one, but it's one I love the best. It has a little more philosophy and personal realizations in it. And that book, Vrindavan, which is written by Raja Shekhar Das Brahmachari, is of probably 5 or 6 or 7 guidebooks to Vrindavan. What does it say above Vrindavan?
The color guide to the color guide.
I think there's been between 5 and 10 guides to Vrindavan written by ISKCON people, and probably 20, 30, 40 more written by non-ISKCON people. Of all of them, as far as I can see, this is the best one. This one is a book that the author took all the pictures, made the maps, made all the diagrams, wrote all the text, and spent probably more time trying to make a definitive volume than anyone else. As far as I can see, it's the best one. So I'd also recommend this book. This map is, he describes it as cartography. And that in itself shows that he's not just into throwing something together, but he's really figured this out, you know, what the dimensions are, what the mileage is, what the shape is, what the distances are. And really get a good picture from this map. Of course, he's obviously come later than the others, so maybe he's drawn on that also. But it looks like a very, very good book. And his plan is to do one on Govardhan and one on Roshana. It'll be similar to this. And on this one, because there's new kuns and temples and holy spots and holy waters being discovered regularly, that he will do an update on this probably in 5 or 10 years to bring out the new places that he's discovered. So this is the kind of thinking we want to take when you go around Vrindavan, or even greater Vrindavan. But it's mostly like the Prakram here. You can just take it and read about the place where you are at. Just like we said the other day at Inli Thalin, a very nice pastime. So you just take the book over and take it. And the other ones aren't bad. There's one that Dhruva wrote, I think is probably the next best one. You've seen that one. It's called Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. And then there's Padma Lochan wrote one. Aditya Pavana wrote one. And I don't remember who else. There's a few others. These are all ISKCON people. And some of them even have maps. This is a definitive volume. So I think we should probably be heading back. Unless someone has a burning question. Yeah, we'll go see the samadhis. I was going to see about what kind of suggestions you might want to make about going back now. We could go back via rickshaw on the street here and risk getting pelted pretty heavily, but we might not. And it's like, you know, we'd have to split up into like 8 groups to do it, or 4 groups, and each get a rickshaw, and they're a little hard to get, but we could do it. It'd take about 15 minutes to get back to the temple. Or we could go back the way we came, if you can imagine going the opposite way against all the crowds. I mean, it's not that big of a deal, and I have a feeling that at this time of day, and I could be wrong about this, this is a siesta sort of time, consistent nap time, that maybe people are sitting down and not walking so much. Maybe they're, you know, staying back. So what we could do is we could just go out there and look, and if it looks like it's going to be too heavy, because some of the paths are very thin, we could just come back here and then, you know, get rickshaws. Too tired or what? Anyone else prefer to feel like I'm really too tired to walk back? At least you're kind of.
I'll share a rickshaw.
Okay, well, there's one rickshaw. All right, well, maybe since you were going to have a rickshaw. All closed, everything's good. sounds a bit, I can't tell, but it sounds a bit quiet. Anybody?
I'll lock
it. Oh, you can go out this door. The side door. Go through Prabhupada's room, and there's a little door there that should be open. What about you, Schubert? You want?
I just would like to run the
corner. Go ahead. Okay, why don't you and Elise go ahead and take a rickshaw? Too late. Yeah, you can go. You can go out this side door here. And what you do is, if there's one waiting, just take that. And I don't know what the cost is usually to Lloyd Bazaar. Eight? Lloyd Bazaar to the temple. Very good. So you should come to Tree Colored Gas so we can make arrangements about going into Delhi. All right, we'll see you there.
Okay.
All right. Hare Krishna.